Welcome to the She Recovers podcast, a collection of audio posts, interviews, and talks curated for our She Recovers community. I'm Taryn Strong, co-founder with my mother, Dawn Nickel, of She Recovers. We believe that we're all recovering from something. And here on She Recovers podcast, we examine the healing power of connection and intentional living, as well as what happens in our lives when we put down our past stories and pick up our soul's true purpose. You can find out more about She Recovers, our intentions and guiding principles, upcoming events and retreats, recovery coaching, online yoga, and so much more on our website, sherecovers.co. In this episode of the She Recovers podcast, Erin talks with Connie McMillan, author of Alcohol Fiend to Sobriety Queen and the host of the Sober Sessions podcast. 6 years ago, tired of living the party life, depleting her bank account, and being everything to everybody all the time, Connie dropped the self-destructive facade and began her journey to become Sobriety Queen Connie, the recovery coach, author, and mentor she is today. Connie shares how some of her greatest heartbreaks, such as a failed marriage, her sister's incarceration, and the death of her mother, became a catalyst for building the life she was meant to live.
So Connie, we met in New York City, and I loved hearing your story. So why don't you just start us off by sharing what you like to tell people about your recovery journey, like how you like to start that conversation.
Well, I've been sober 5 years. Couple of weeks this month will be 6 years. You know, as I said, listen, I suffered for 10 plus years just realizing that alcohol wasn't my friend. I really thought that we had a special connection, and I thought that the more I drank, the better I would become, the more people would accept me, only to find out that was a lie. I was falling fast. I can remember celebrating my 40th birthday, having on some like $800 shoes because I definitely was this girl who I just wanted to, I would buy stuff to make myself feel good and drink, of course. And I remember at the end of that night, in these amazing red bottoms, I remember getting to my building and pissing on myself, literally. And, you know, I was just really, really going through a lot of things, and I was self-medicating, but that wasn't helping. I really found that the more I drank, the worse I became. And I was tired of that. I was tired of living this lie. I was tired of maximizing my credit cards or maxing out my credit cards and depleting my bank account and depleting my self-worth and really staying in the company of people who maybe somewhat cared, but just didn't know how to help me, or maybe too afraid, because I was the girl in the group who was so used to pouring out, giving out, and uplifting other people and camouflaging who I really was and how much pain I was really in. I was tired of that. And I knew that I had to get the help I needed. Otherwise, I was just going to die. That was just going to be it. I was not going to be here.
So you said you were going through a lot of things, and you shared a little bit about what you were going through in New York when you spoke at the She Recovers Creating Connections tour. Would you want to share some of that with us
here? Oh, yeah. So let's see, where do we first start at? I was in a marriage that had already dissolved, but I was just staying to the five-year mark, if that makes any sense. A lot of verbal abuse I was accepting, but I also was expecting him to build me up. That just was never going to happen. I was also self-medicated as a result of that. My mother was near her deathbed, literally, as a result of her drinking. My sister was incarcerated. So I was trying to be everything to everybody. Meanwhile, I had nothing left to even give. I didn't want my mom to cry anymore for my sister being incarcerated because she missed her firstborn, you know, not seeing her face, missing holidays and so forth. I wanted to be her comfort. Meanwhile, I was a wife and I wanted to, you know, pour into my husband and make him feel better because he was a gentleman that was a heavy gentleman and I knew he had insecurities. So I was trying to make him feel better about himself all while trying to make myself feel good about me, but it wasn't working out. And I just was rolling on empty. I really was. But yet to the world, I looked like this amazing girl. I had all the designer clothing and, you know, I put on a good front. I put on a good front, not realizing that it was going to crumble at some point, literally. And that's what happened. I got to that point where my marriage failed. We wound up getting a divorce. My mother died. My sister did eventually come home from jail. But at this point, I was just lost. I didn't know who Connie was. And, you know, the only way I found her was to cry out to God, literally just take that time and say, God, if you don't help me, I'm going to die. I know it. I have nothing else to give. I have nobody else to lean on because I was leaning on my mom, leaning on my ex-husband. I have nobody else to lean on. And I kind of feel like God was a little upset with me, like you're leaning on everybody else. And here I am. So, I was staying at my mom's house before she passed. I was living at my mom's house. And because the marriage had dissolved first, and then I stayed with my mom, which was, you know, if anybody's ever moved out of their mother's apartment and had to go back, you know, that's the worst thing you want to do in life. So I did what I had to do. But I remember while being there, I went on Craigslist. And I looked for an apartment in Brooklyn because that was what I knew. I was always a Brooklyn-born girl, and I didn't want to go outside of my comfort zone. And this apartment came up. It was absolutely gorgeous. I was always a lover of sunken living rooms when I was a little girl. And I was like, I want that apartment. And I remember looking at the phone number to dial to call to see if it was still available. And it was, but the area code said 973. And I'm like, wait, who? I'm not going to Jersey. Like, I want to go to Brooklyn. I clicked Brooklyn. That was the header I clicked. And I couldn't get that image out of my head. So I dialed the number. Lo and behold, I moved to New Jersey. Still was drinking at that time because, you know, that was what I knew. And I also needed to mask the pain of my mom passing, of my ex-husband and I, our marriage dissolving. And I still was missing my sister. So that went on. I moved in 2012. I drank until really the end of 2013. That was really when I got sober, but I always kind of attribute it to 2014. But my mother was lying in that casket. That was it for me. I was like, yeah, I got to get it together. I got to break this cycle. But moving out to New Jersey was where I was able to get that done. Because if I had stayed in Brooklyn, and I feel like God knew it, if I stayed in Brooklyn, I would have just gone right back to my behaviors. I would have found another way to make an excuse, found another way to, you know, indulge and mask my pain the more and really not live out the gift that God had already put in me. That makes sense.
So your mother's death anniversary is also your sobriety date?
It absolutely is. It absolutely is. Yeah. January 16th, 2014, that's when she passed away. Yeah.
That's amazing. That's amazing. So moving out to New Jersey, you've lost your mom, your sister is still in prison, and you are in a new city.
Yeah.
And what do you do? How do you start rebuilding?
I've always been like a chatter. So I've always been friendly. I remember, so now I'm in a different apartment. I used to live upstairs. So I'm on the first floor. I used to be on the second floor. And my next door neighbor and I, we just would, you know, start off with the greetings, hello. And, you know, it's the short conversations. And before you knew it, I had one friend, right? I had one friend that I could encourage. Even though I still, you know, had that brokenness in me. It was just that ability to pour into people. I've always loved and enjoyed doing that. It's just a part of who I am. And
so this friend, I'm gonna stop you just so I want to make sure I understand. This friend wasn't encouraging you. This new friend.
No, she wasn't.
You were encouraging her.
Yes.
Was she also trying to be sober?
No. She just was a neighbor that, you know, again, I just would see her and I would just either tell her something, whatever God would pour in my heart to tell her. And I just would just add comforting words to her. And we're like this close now, even though I moved downstairs. So, and before you know it, I just would see other people in the neighborhood. And I would just, you know, just add something. Even the little girls. I remember the little girls in my building. I would always, you know, tell them how beautiful they are. And I did that because, again, I was struggling with self-esteem. And I knew that, you know, as a brown chocolate girl, growing up in the 1970s, that wasn't highlighted. Like, if you were light, you were it. You were beautiful. That's just what it was. And so I didn't want those little girls to feel the way I felt. And they were really, really chocolate, really, really dark skin. And so I would just do what I didn't get. I would give what I didn't get as a child. So I would pour into them. And then I started going to church more regularly because I was not consistent in going to church. I started reading my word. I started crying and, you know, acknowledging some of my responsibilities to that marriage, acknowledging how I contributed to the dissolve of it. I also started realizing that, you know, my mom wasn't the first person in our family to pass away from alcohol abuse. You know, all of her siblings, with the exception of one that was murdered. I understood that this was a long history of drinking and abusing. This was in our bloodline. And I knew that I had a chance to break that. I knew I had a chance to say, you know, my little cousins get to see somebody sober, and not just see them sober, but see what it looks like, how, you know, how much of a blessing it is, and see how far your life can go without alcohol. Because as I started to say before, my house was the house that, you know, my mom was the matriarch. So my house was the house that everybody came to. Every holiday, every funeral, everybody came to our house. So, you know, there would be fish fries on Friday night and salad, and there would be all types of events that would happen at our house, but drinking was always present. It was always a thing that we saw. And, you know, my sister still struggles with alcohol abuse to this day. My cousins drink, you know, so I knew I had to make a decision. And it wasn't easy, right? It wasn't easy being the person who did not drink. You know, I'm jumping a little ahead, but someone had asked me, how did I get the name Sobriety Queen? And I got that as a joke from my sister. When I would come from New Jersey and go to New York to visit my family, she would say to relatives or friends, whoever would be there, because she still resides in the house that my mom passed away in. And she would say, put your drinks away. Here comes the Sobriety Queen. And, you know, and I would laugh it off. And she kept saying it. And I said, you know what? I'm going to take that name. So I just incorporated that into my life. I embraced, you know, what was meant to, you know, make me feel uncomfortable. I added it to my life. So I know I kind of went off the deep end, but I knew that, you know, again, it was my responsibility to say, you know, God has granted you this ability to abstain. He has afforded me the opportunity to start a business as a result of it. And now I get to show people what's possible with sobriety. And I don't take that lightly.
Yeah. I really like that you just used the word responsibility in the way you did, because I had a therapist who once explained to me that he liked to parse that word apart, responsibility. And he would say, you have it's response and ability. So you have an ability to respond, and not everyone does, right? So you have many family members, it sounds like, who also are experiencing their own challenges with substance abuse and with a lack of self-love, right? And yet they are still mired in that, but you have an ability to respond, same circumstances, in a different way.
Absolutely.
And I love that you have recognized that as not just an opportunity for yourself, but you are drawing a line for the generations to come.
Yes.
For your descendants.
Yes.
I mean, we talk a lot about the challenges of our, you know, this generational trauma, mm-hmm. right? And the generational addictions and, yes. and what I love is when you start to think about not just those who've come before you and their struggles, but our descendants, right? Our children, our grandchildren, our nieces, our nephews.
Yes.
And the impact that your choice has on all of those lives to come.
Absolutely.
Is so freaking cool.
As you said, it's our responsibility. We have choices in life, right? And some choices are made for us and some aren't, right? So I didn't decide to be born, but I was born. And, you know, I got to see, you know, that my mom masked her pain too. My mother's mother died when my mother was 19 years old. And my mother raised her 4 siblings by herself. So that in itself explained to me why she was masking all this pain. I mean, she was a child herself raising children. And, you know, when I think about my 19-year-old self, I didn't know anything. I had no clue. So it helped me to understand why she drank the way that she did. But also it helped me to understand that she was a woman of strength. You know, a woman who said that it's my responsibility to take care of my 2 daughters. Yes, they will see me drinking, but they will also see, you know, how strong they are as well. They'll see my strength and they'll draw from that. And I have, honestly, I've always been a woman that pushed forward, that want to see the best in others. I get that from my mom. My mom has always been giving and caring, you know, but I also just picked up the fact that drinking was something that, you know, came along with it. And I'm grateful that, you know, that I can separate that part, that I can say, okay, I saw that, but that's not the part that I want to keep. That's not the part that I want to add to my life. I want to show people that, you know, your life can be better without this substance. You know, we all have hardships. We all go through things, but I want you to see that when you incorporate alcohol or addiction into your life, it takes away from your ability to be able to not only function at the high level that, you know, again, that God has called you to be, but it also takes away from your self-esteem, your self-worth. It doesn't allow you to make great choices, right? So that's what my life's focus is, letting people see. You know, I remember asking God, I said, I'll be the guinea pig. If you help me with this, I'm getting emotional. I remember that was my prayer. If you help me get sober, I'll tell everything. I won't hold back anything. And that's what I've been doing.
Wow, friend. So you move to New Jersey, you meet this neighbor who isn't struggling with substance abuse, but has everyday struggles as a human being. And you start pouring your encouragement mm-hmm. into this person. Is it a woman or a man?
It's a woman.
To this friend, this girlfriend. And that I think you've built on that. I mean, as I looked over your materials, your Instagram account, you've created 10 tips for sobriety that you've posted on your LinkedIn tree there. And it seems like this focus on others is at the heart of your recovery.
Yes.
You even discourage people from counting days. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, you know, counting days, you lose focus of your main focus, right? So yes, it's cool to say I have 1,000 days. I mean, I definitely don't want to discredit anybody from achieving that number, but you're saying you have 1,000 days really is so that everybody else can acknowledge it too, so that they can say, yay for you. And once they do that, there goes, you know, validation. And it doesn't really help you, for some, it doesn't really help them pursue the focus of showing other people how to get 1,000 days, right? I like to say, like, you know, we have a day that we were born, a day we were meant to die. And that dash in between is what matters. So you have gone from, you know, 0 days to 1,000 days, but that dash in there, how did you get there? That's what people need to know. They need to know what it took to get there so that they too can see what's possible, right? So that they're not just seeing this big number. Because some people will never see that big number, right? For them, that number is not even an option. So if it's just 50 days, if it's just a day, you still have the ability to pour into somebody's life. You still have the opportunity to tell someone what you did to get to that so that they too can find hope, find strength, find, you know, the ability to, you know, just feel reborn or rebuilt, right? They don't have to feel like it's over for me. Oh my gosh, she did it or he did it. I can now do it too. And I have the skills or the information and how to get there. So that's what I mean.
Yeah. It's such a personal, the numbers game is a very personal thing, mm-hmm. because counting numbers at the beginning, very helpful to me. Mm-hmm. My daily counter has been very helpful to help me gain traction. Mm-hmm. However, I have a different sobriety date, quote unquote, than a recovery date. Mm-hmm. And but conversations can get very sensitive around all of that.
Oh, yeah.
All of which is to say, everybody has to do what works for them, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And so if it works for you to count days, count days. Count hours, count whatever, right? I mean, we recently, there's been, articles and about different modalities of recovery and what works and what doesn't work and people judging other people for being in AA or not in AA meetings, mm-hmm. or counting days or not counting. I loved what you said about the days because I hadn't heard that before.
Yeah.
And I also love it when it works. Right? So whatever keeps you on your recovery path is the right thing.
Well, I'm not
and I love
counting days. I think you can count days. There's nothing wrong with counting days, but just know that's not the premise of it all, right? As you're mm-hmm. counting your days, make sure you're looking back to help somebody else, you know, explain to them how you got to those days. That's all I'm saying. Don't focus on just the days alone.
Yeah, yeah. It is about other people.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's such a balance between ego and soul, or ego and whatever else is not driving that. Yeah.
So true. So true.
Yeah.
Humility is what you want on this journey. You need humility. You do. I mean,
absolutely.
It doesn't even matter what path you're taking, but humility will be it, right? Because you never want to get to a place where you've arrived and you're better and, you know, or people just looking at you like you're some god, right? That's not even in my frame of thought, but you know, I'm always asking God to humble me because it's easy. It can happen to anybody, right? But we want to definitely, as you said, stay, that balance has to be focused. You really want balance in your life. I could totally agree with you on that.
Your number one sober strategy for 2020 is to refuse to receive or believe anything negative about myself. Example, tell old corrupt thoughts goodbye. You don't live here anymore. God has begun a new thing inside of me. So love yourself.
Yes.
Also keep yourself in check, right? It's this tension, this balance, right?
Yes.
So let's talk about some of these sobriety strategies because they're fantastic and you can find them on through your IG account, just, you know, in your bio, there's a link there.
Mm-hmm.
You have 10 fantastic tips. And that's the first thing is don't believe anything negative about yourself. So maybe you just want to say a little bit about that.
Well, I think that, you know, it's so important that, listen, when we were on or out there drinking, how much negative information have we taken in? We're looking at other people and how they view us, myself included. Like I looked at, you know, the words that were said about me, you know, I believe those things. So if you continue to do that, if you're holding on to those negative ways and thought patterns, they'll weigh heavy on you and you will not be able to, you know, see yourself as this sober queen that you are, right? We want to make sure that we are making sure that we're emptying that trash as often as possible. That is key. So how do you do something like that? you know, you're able to separate yourselves maybe from the certain crowds that contributed to that, right? That can be you totally Xing them out your life. It's 2020. You might say, listen, I don't have time for that. God bless you. I got to move forward. Or you might have to do it gradually, minimizing your conversations with them, right? Once they start talking a little negative, oh my gosh, I've got something on the stove, or I've got another phone call, whatever you need to use to get off that phone, because you don't need those negative seeds being planted in your lives. So minimizing the phone, the energy that's coming in, that negative energy, or just Xing it out altogether. That's definitely one or two ways you can do it.
Yeah, it's the company you keep. And it's the company you keep inside your head and outside your head, right? So no negative thoughts, no negative thoughts in your head, and no negative energies and personalities, you know, outside. Yeah. It requires a lot of bravery. It requires a lot of bravery. And I think that there's a period of time when you're newly sober and you're really committed to it of loneliness. There's a period of time where it's just going to be lonely.
Yeah.
And you got to sit with yourself.
Yeah.
And I think that that happens because we have to come to know ourselves, our true selves, not that self that alcohol gives us, not the self that the world told us we were.
Yes.
All those stories, we have to come to kind of sort through those stories and decide, what am I going to keep and what am I going to push, you know, say no thank you to,
yeah,
and then rebuild from there. But there is a period of loneliness that I really find as I talk more and more with women who have, undergone a recovery, that it's just lonely for a little bit.
It is. I mean, you can't even escape that. It is. When I moved out here, I was lonely. I didn't know anybody. So me talking to my neighbor was like, yay, you know, I got a friend. Like, I knew no one out here. I shouldn't say that. I did know one person, but they drank and they smoked. So I knew we were never going to see each other. That was not even going to be an option. And we didn't. But it's that fear of being by yourself, you know, having that quiet time, you know, of decluttering. And we don't like to do the hard work. And that is hard work. We don't like to do that, but not realizing that the hard work is what's going to help us. It's not just going to help us, you know, in that moment, but it's going to help us along the way. And, you know, one of the tips I have even in my book is, you know, being able to separate yourselves from your old friends. I say, like, finding a new crew. You know, you kind of go through that whole battle, you know, will I even have a new crew in this sobriety arena, right? Will I make friends? And I always attribute that to, as I said, cleaning house, right? So you're going to have to say goodbye to some folks. It doesn't mean that you don't love them, but it's like if you were doing spring cleaning, you knew you can't keep everything in the house, right? You got to declutter. You got to get rid of some things. And you get rid of those things. And this place, obviously people, but you get rid of them so that new ones can come aboard. If you keep everything, going back to the spring cleaning, if you keep everything, how do you now, you know, get the new sunshine or the new things that you need for the house and that makes the house even better and brighter? It doesn't happen. You've got to declutter in order to get the things that, you know, will add to you. And even including yourself, you've got to be able to do it, ensuring that there will be some new people that will come in your life because you are now new. You are now whole. You now love you. So you're going to attract those people. If that makes sense.
It makes sense for absolutely. And so one of the things that you have along with your, and the strategies is to make the weekend time a time of appreciation rather than celebration. So maybe these friends that you're divorcing from, that's hard though, again. So I would love to hear your thoughts on how to make this transition from a party. I have to tell you, our stories are different because I was not a partier.
Okay.
So, like your red shoe bottom. I isolated. I was a couch potato and everything was very, hidden. So I didn't mind the transition to loneliness as much as some people. Mm-hmm. Not again, you don't stay lonely forever, people, but there is a little time here. So But I know I have friends who, you know, they really were partiers out and about, and that was hard for them. So I would love to hear your thoughts on that transition.
Well, so the weekend for me was a celebration. When the weekend came, it was like, yes, you know, no work, it's all play. And I had to learn how to go from that. You know, my weekends was the time I drank. I hung out with the girls, and I had to learn how to transition to what you're saying, like the downtime, the me time. I went to the movies by myself. You know, I learned how to celebrate me or enjoy my own company. And that was something that I had never do. I would have never done that. That's number one. That's just, to me, that was just weird. So I didn't learn how to do that. So I had to learn how to appreciate me. So yeah, let's say that, you know, again, my weekends was that time when I used to party. Now I'm transitioning to, all right, how can I appreciate, you know, the fact that I went to work, I didn't drink this whole week. You know, I'm learning self-love. I'm using affirmations. What do I want to do as a token of appreciation for myself? Well, I'll go to the movies by myself. I'll go see something funny because I love to laugh. So I might go see Kevin Hart, right? Or Will Smith with Martin Lawrence or whatever. Something that's going to make me crack up because that's what I like to do. I also, you know, I'm a girly girl, so I might just go out and get my nails done and my toes done. You know, I might stop off at Sephora and get me some red lipstick. You know, something that's going to show me that I love me and that this is cool for me. I'm good with this and I appreciate myself, and that it doesn't have to be in a club or in a bottle. So, you know, it could be a picnic. It doesn't have to be something, you know, on that level, but it can be in a space where you are just taking out time for yourself. You're loving on you. And that in itself feels really good.
Mm-hmm. So all of your strategies you connected, the 10 strategies that you've written, they're beautiful. You've connected them all to a Bible phrase. Yes. Or verse, I should say, sorry. Yes. So I would love to have you talk about the importance of that for you.
Well, for me, I'm a faith girl. I love God. You know, he is the reason why I am here, and he's the reason why we're all alive, be it if you, you know, you acknowledge it or not. But you don't have to do it the way I do it. But for me, he is the foundation of my life. And I also have found that, you know, anything that I want to bring forth to someone, I'm going to make sure that I go to the Bible and show proof that this is evidence of what is true, right? There are scriptures in the Bible that tell us about, you know, about drinking and being drunk, right? Someone else could twist it around and say, oh, well, you know, the Jesus turned water into wine, right? You know, they might do that too. But that's just part of the part that works for them, right? They're not reading the entire passage, if you will. But I think it's important that the Bible is not just a book to read. It's a book of instruction. It's a book of wisdom. It's a book that really can help us, you know, get through a whole lot of things in life. You know, God has given us that. So yeah, I think that, you know, my whole point in writing these 10 strategies, I wanted to be able to show you where I got that information or why that information is so key, not to just me, but to the lives that, you know, takes this information and applies it.
Yeah. And, you know, you said that you and your, when you first kind of started off on this journey, your mom had died, and that you had this deal with God, right? That if you could really, yes, embrace recovery,
yes,
that you would talk about it and he would support you in that.
Yep.
So how has your relationship with your higher power or God, or however other people describe this person, but you do, or this being, and you use the word God, so I'm going to use the word God.
Okay.
How has that relationship changed over the 6 years that you've been sober?
He's taught me, you know, who I am and what my worth is, right? I've learned through reading God's word that I'm a masterpiece. I've learned that, you know, that I am beautiful and wonderfully made. You know, I've learned that reading his word comforts me. it adds to me, and it teaches me how to add to other people. Because sometimes we don't know who we are. We don't even know what we possess, because again, we've been seeking our validation through others. But I've come to know through reading God's word that all the validation that I need is in his word. I don't need anybody else's validation. So, you know, for some people that may come across as maybe a little cocky. I mean, I know that I'm not, but I'm just saying, you know, sometimes people misconstrue self-confidence. They don't really attribute it to a person doing the work, you know, being able to look at themselves and break down those barriers and do that hard work. They don't really attribute it to that. They attribute it to, oh, she just thinks she's all about her, but not realizing that I've had to cry a whole lot of days. I've had to do a whole lot of work. So having that relationship with God, it keeps me grounded, it keeps me focused, and it keeps me in a space of being able to help other people, remind them of who they are and whose they are and the path that, you know, he's created just for not just me, but you too. And, you know, you are not, you know, who you think you are or what you've done. You know, you are God's chosen. And that is essential, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder if that's, I'm kind of focused right now in about the lonely phase, because I have a new friend who's newly sober, and she's lonely. And she's been sober 4 months. Mm-hmm. And she knows she wants to stay sober, but she's also really feeling, especially coming off of the holidays, you know, she's really feeling othered throughout parties and even with her family. Right. And I wonder if that's why the lonely part has to come, why this little self-isolation phase really settles on you, so that you do begin to recognize your greatness.
Yeah.
And you do start to feel more comfortable not staying small, not staying quiet.
Yeah.
And I've really been surprised, even those who love you the most, even when you're getting healthier, it's, you know, they don't necessarily love it for you.
Right.
And they kind of want you to stay stuck in the old stories about yourself.
Yes.
That they're comfortable with and that you used to be comfortable with. So I'm wondering what stories, Connie, you tell yourself about yourself now? Like, how has that shifted for you?
You know, I do reflect a lot. It's interesting that you said that, because I was a girl who got left back in second grade, and, you know, my sister read better than I did. And, you know, I can remember my mom sitting hours and hours at the kitchen table with books and going over words with me. And, you know, I used to think that I was the slow one, you know, of course, being left back. I'm like, oh, I'm not as smart as my sister. And having gone through all of that, you know, I now look at myself and say, maybe I had to go through those things. I had to go through those things just so that I can appreciate who I've become today, how I've worked hard on that. And not just so it could benefit me, but so that I can see that in other people, so that I can give them a story to tell them from whence I've come, right? I feel like it's so important that we understand certain things we've had to go through. Right? It just, you can't skip cycles. It just doesn't happen. And in that moment, you don't understand. In that moment, you're like, why me? Or, you know, will it ever change? That's definitely something, you know, you ask yourself. But I can remember when the shift did change. I can remember when, and I've told this story once or twice before, but I can remember my mom probably just getting frustrated, like, oh my gosh, this girl is just gonna drive me crazy. And I can remember being in junior high school and going to the counselor's office. My mom was there, and I can't remember why we were there, but whatever, she had to be there. And she said, the counselor had said, you know, well, Connie has enough credits to go to the eighth grade. And my mom looking like, yeah, right. And I was like, I was taken aback. Like, wait a minute. Have you doubted me too? Like, have you counted me out? And I mean, of course she didn't, but that was her response. So I remember feeling some type of way, you know, like, really? Is that what you do? And from that moment on, and even I think into my adulthood, I've learned to say to myself, nobody else will ever doubt me in life. And I don't care how far I've fallen. And I can say this to all the listeners, there's been a time in your life, if there has, and I believe there has been, when someone's doubted you, they've spoken ill of you, right? Even if you haven't had a chance to, you know, say to them verbally, you'll never do that to me again, you can say it today. You have the power to say, no one will ever doubt me again. Why? Because I will fight for me. I'll fight for me today, and I'll fight for the future me. So I kind of always attributed that. I've always been this girl who said, I may fall, but I'm going to get back up. I don't know how, you know, I don't know at what point, but I'm going to get back up. And that's how it was even on my journey, my sobriety journey. I tried to get sober many times. You know, I would stop drinking Long Island iced tea and go to wine, which I knew I hated wine because it only made me go to sleep. And what girl who likes to party and look cute wants to go to sleep? Nobody. I don't want to go to sleep. I want to have a good time. So that did not work. But, you know, even as I did, you know, start my journey and I was able to, you know, abstain, God had to remind me of, you know, the words that I spoke about myself. So that was, you know, not letting anybody define me, not letting anybody, you know, prove me or prove them right. Right. Because that's another thing. You got to sometimes have that talk with yourself. Like, I won't prove anybody right. So if you called me a failure, if you called me left back, or if you called me a tramp, or if you called me whatever negative words, you got to be able to look at yourself and say, I love me. I'm a beautiful queen. You know, I'm chosen. I'm above and not beneath. I'm ahead and not, you know, I'm the head and not the tail, right? God sees the best in me, right? Everything that's happened to me, it has not happened to me, it's happened for me. So sometimes you got to encourage yourself. And that's the route that, you know, that I speak. That's what I teach, because I didn't have that necessarily growing up. I had to find that. And just one other story, I know I'm going on, but I remember when I was in college and I had a professor say to me, it was like my last semester before I got my BA. And I was super excited about this. I was like, yes, I need my GPA to be a 4.0. And if not, at least a 3.8. And I remember being in college and we had to do a presentation. And you know, public speaking is the most feared thing for everybody. And I remember having to present to my professor. I think I spoke about affordable housing. Look, how many years have I been at college and I still remember that topic. And I spoke about, I shared about, you know, the benefits of it or disadvantages really. But anyways, I remember my professor critiquing me afterwards. And she said to me, you need to be a public speaker. And I was like, what? Who are you talking to, lady? And I really said that. And she says, you really need to do that. So I'm sharing that story to say to you, as you're on your journey, maybe you know what your calling is. Maybe you know what your heart's desire is. Maybe you don't. But I guarantee you, if you keep going, if you keep surrounding yourselves in the right environments, if you keep doing the work, somebody's going to come along. If they don't tell you, then it will just show up. You'll be surprised as to why you were created. There's a reason. There's a reason. And it could be public speaking. It could be, you know, whatever, just making someone laugh. It could be whatever, but I guarantee you, it's something that was created just for you. And it's so important that you keep moving along your journey just so that that one thing can be uncovered so that you can leave your mark on this world. You have everything you need, I guarantee you.
It can be showing your niece and nephew, you know, if you don't have children, it can be showing your niece and nephew that you can live without alcohol, even though it's been in your family forever and ever. And I love that you have what I call a little bit of fuck you in you, right? You have a little bit of, and it's funny because I do have children. I have two boys.
Okay.
And I have one that came out with a little bit of fuck you. And I have one that frankly was compliant as a younger child. He was compliant. And now as teenagers, I got to tell you, I don't worry about the one with a little bit of fuck you in him.
Yeah.
Because he's out in the world and he knows exactly who he is. Mm-hmm. It's the one who was compliant when he was a toddler and a little boy who now I'm like, oh gosh, I don't want you to be compliant.
Right.
You know, I want you. And as women in recovery, I think you need to discover your little fuck you.
Yes.
I think you need to find that nugget and that ember, and you need to wave, you know, give it some oxygen and flame, you know, let it breathe and let it really develop. And I think that you know, that is, no matter what your recovery story, fanning that flame of defiance and changing your story around what is possible, that is like the collective recovery.
Yes.
Because the world has, we have a lot of problems in the world, you know, and they're not being solved by pouring wine and Long Island iced teas down our throats. So, yeah. So it's just so important. You don't have to be a public speaker. You don't have to have a podcast. You don't have to do anything.
That's right.
But stay in recovery and keep your story straight in your head.
Yeah.
About who you are and what's possible for you.
Yeah.
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 Which leaves us, so we're running out of time. And I guess I'm going to ask you, I guess I'll kind of wrap up with our question about dreams, about what dreams you have for yourself and your future now that you know that the possibilities are actually endless and so expansive, what's truly available to you. Because it gives me goosebumps thinking about it, right?
Yes.
So Connie McMillan, tell us what dreams you have for yourself. What's ahead for you?
Well, I have a dream of helping 100,000 women see what's possible for their lives in sobriety. And as you said, and I love it, it doesn't have to be on a higher scale the way, you know, you and I and others do it. It's not about that, right? But it's about being able to just pour into other lives. I think we live in this world where alcohol says yes, and you're the girl, and you're this, and you're that. If I can be able to touch 100,000 women or men, I'm not opposed, right? but if I can touch their lives so they can be examples, as you said, to their children or children's children or whomever, then we can live in a world where we can shift that way of thinking about alcohol. So that's like my biggest dream. My second dream is to build a few sober houses, to be able to have women housed in a space where it's not just about, you know, did you take a test today, or, you know, did you read the big book? And I'm sorry, it is what it is. I have to be honest. It's not about that. It's about, you know, helping them develop even on smaller levels, right? So maybe that's just pouring back into them some joy. Maybe that's just, you know, speaking God's words. Maybe that's just having their children come to the house. I don't know. Whatever that small thing is that can make them feel great. Also helping them to build not just a sobriety legacy, but help them to be able to get in a space of rebuilding their own lives. So maybe that can be getting a job, that can be enhancing their computer skills, or maybe they want to be an entrepreneur. But adding in that way, that's so important to me as women. We've been out there, some women have been out there for a very long time, and they tend to think that there's no hope. But I'd like for my sober houses to be a space of them knowing that you are the queen. Like, God has not forgotten you, and you still have purpose on your life. So I want my house to be able to add value to the lives, not just, you know, emotionally, financially, spiritually, academically, so that they can be self-sufficient and then pass it on to someone else, you know, so they'll stay in this house no more than a year and they'll leave, you know, with all the tools, everything they need. And then we'll get more women to come in and we'll just keep recycling that. I guess, you know, for me personally, I just would like a house in Hawaii if I just want to go there and just like a beach house. Like, I live in New Jersey, so I hate the winters. So I'm like, yeah, what is that season? Oh yeah, I'm going to Hawaii for a few months and still be able to work from wherever I am. So that's my dream. I don't really have like, you know, big dreams for myself. I'm so big on helping other people. So I know God will just be like, let me just give this girl something. She's just going to give everything away.
Well, you give everything away, but then you get everything back and then some. I love sober houses. That is beautiful. I want to figure out how I can help you with that dream. That's everything.
I need help.
Women. Yeah. Women supporting women is where it's at.
Yes.
That's where it's at.
Yes.
So I'm so grateful that you put down your Long Island iced tea. Yes. Do you still have red bottom shoes?
I do. I don't even wear them. I do still have them, though.
Yeah, they're fun to like look at, maybe.
Yep. They look like Dorothy slippers. Like they're like really shimmery and shiny. Like they're pretty, but I don't even wear those. Things hurt your feet like crazy. I don't even wear them. If I can give them away, I'll give them away. Like I don't even care.
Well, girl, you should sell them for your and put that money toward these sober houses. Right?
You're right. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, don't be giving away the red bottom shoes. Like, that's pretty penny right there.
Good idea.
Yeah. I am so grateful that you put down the Long Island iced tea and picked up yourself. Yeah. And I loved meeting you in New York. And I'm so grateful that you suffered with me here at the beginning. We had a lot of audio issues at the beginning, but I think we solved them through your help. So you're already helping other women with random problems. But thank you so much for joining us today. And people can find you. You want to tell us where people can find you? Where would you like people to connect with you?
So as you said, Sobriety Queen Connie, Facebook, Sobriety Queen Connie, Facebook, Instagram, that's where you'll mostly find me. Either of those platforms. Or you can send me a friend request. Like I'm very friendly. You can send me, it's Connie McMillan. So you can definitely send me a friend request. You know, I've got my book out. We celebrated 1 year, Alcohol Fiends and Sobriety Queen. So that's also on my website, which is www.conniesmcmillan.com. I got loads of resources there. The podcast will be debuting this month, the 16th. I'm super excited about that. Make sure you guys mark your calendars. We're going to have some amazing guests on. Why? Because that podcast is just about showing people, queens and kings, what's possible with sobriety. So the guests that are coming on that show, they're literally living testaments of, you know, you can start from the bottom, but I guarantee you, you will end up, you know, in the place that you want if you keep putting in the work. So these guests are just sharing it all, good, bad, and ugly. They are sharing it. And that's what I love about, you know, a podcast. You get to really get the real side of people. There's no sugarcoating, thankfully. So yeah, that's what I have coming up.
And so that's called Sober Sessions is the podcast, right?
Yes, the podcast is called Sober Sessions. And on the podcast, we have Sober Sessions Confessions. So that's a little hook. And as I said, you know, these women are just giving out, they're pouring out everything, literally. And that's what I love about it. I mean, I want people, well, kind of like me, you're going to tell it all. Like you're not about to hide anything because that's not who I am. And then lastly, I want to share that we've got the Winning in Life Sober course. It's actually debuting on the 7th of this month, so in a couple of days. And that is just an 8-day course that I will be hosting via Zoom. And you know, we're going to cover different topics or subjects, I should say, like first is kind of just going through a burning session. So that's more like burning all of your thoughts, your negative thoughts that you have about yourself that you've allowed other people to kind of pour into you. So we want to get rid of that. We want to clean house. We'll go through, you know, the self-esteem, right? The negative self-esteem, kind of like what we've been viewing ourselves as. We'll rebuild the self-esteem with some 5 tips. We're also going through the kind of like a role play, you know, I am my sister's keeper. So you'll pour into your sister will pour into you. I mean, it's just going to be 8 days of work. This is not a course where you're just going to hear me talk. You're going to do some work. And so actually it is $47 for 8 days. Yeah, where do you get that at? But it's $47 until January 7th. Let me say that. And thereafter, it is $97. So if I was you, I'd get on that $47.
So we're not, this podcast will air later in January after all of these things. It will be either late January or early February. So all of that will be available by the time.
Yes.
This is published.
And by then, it'll be available for a replay. So you'll be able to get it at a discounted price. So it won't even matter.
Awesome. Connie, thank you so much for everything. Just thank you for being here and for all your work that you're putting out and for focusing on helping other women and just being amazingly beautiful.
Thank you so much. I really
inside and out. Inside and out.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the She Recovers podcast. We hope you will share, rate, subscribe, and help us spread the word. You can always find out more about She Recovers, our intentions and guiding principles, upcoming events and retreats, recovery coaching, online yoga, and so much more on our website, sherecovers.co. And while you're there, sign up for our newsletter so that we can stay in touch.